rolling. All right, who's up?
Harold.
So I ask my favorite question.
Should I turn it off?
We were thinking about it. The question is, would you give us a little background of how this whole thing started, renovating Temple Road of Shoals?
You're talking about the current restoration.
Yes.
Which is not quite completed.
Right.
Well, the immediate cause, even though it may be denied, was rainwater. We had been having leaks. It is a magnificent building with unusual architecture. Hornbostel designed this as his masterpiece. At least many people feel that it's his masterpiece. Better than Soldiers and Sailors, better than the Pitt initial Oakland campus going up the hill, better than the original Carnegie Tech, actually then it was Carnegie Technical Schools. Mm-hmm. However, through the years, given the dreadful atmosphere of Pittsburgh, until the post-World War II cleanup, leaks developed. We would attempt to repair things year in and year out. The immediate cause was that one Saturday morning, when our president, Sidney Bucis, was worshiping, I could see him going through strange motions. It was a rainy Shabbos morning, and I knew that the leak was directly over him, and he was being rained on. We were then galvanized into action. Joel Kronick, who is an architect, yes, and at that time was chairman of our building committee, simply reported to the board that as an architect, he doesn't know what goes on and doesn't go on with this structure. He said that he was embarrassed to bring in roofers and other artisans to repair. He said he would like to have a complete survey done of this building to find out what we would have to do to make it waterproof for 10, 20, 30 years, not for 3 weeks or 6 months. The board was given an estimate that it might cost $7.5 million to restore the exterior and the interior of the original 1907 sanctuary. There would be other minor elements involved to other parts of the building which were newer parts. The board considered whether to tear down this building and perhaps at a lesser cost build a brand new building. That discussion lasted somewhere between 23 and 27 seconds. They agreed that this building had historic significance, not merely for the Jewish community and for the congregation, but for the whole Pittsburgh area. The structure is on the National Register of Historic Places. When we were placed on the register, that's the Department of Interior of the United States government. It's not the Local Landmarks Foundation, and it's not the Commonwealth, whatever listing they have. This is the federal government, and at the time we went on, there were only 6 other synagogues in all the United States on that register. So their feelings were the correct feelings, that we must do what must be done in order to restore this building. We engaged professional fundraisers, and when they left, we continued on our own. During construction, we realized that the $7.5 million campaign would have to be a $9 million campaign in order to keep some of that money invested so that that income on a new fund would assure that into the future, as repairs would be necessary, there would always be money there to take care of it. I'm pleased to report that we're past the $8 million mark against an original goal of $7.5 million. We were particularly fortunate in that a member of the congregation and his wife, Henry Posner Jr., and his wife, Helen, gave us a magnificent gift. I don't want to give you a dollar figure. I'll just say it's considerably in excess of $1 million. He became very involved in restoring that sanctuary. He wanted it to be something even more beautiful than it had been. And if you've looked at it as we've rededicated it, it is something more beautiful than it was at its inception.
Who was the architect? Who was the architect and builder?
Originally, it was Hornbostel.
Yes,
the original
that,
building.
Of the reconstruction.
Sorry, well, it's been a New York firm. The name for the moment escapes me. So-and-so and X. I guess they are architects. Among others, they restored the Woolworth Building in Manhattan.
Yeah, right.
They have a national reputation. But I want to continue.
Please.
Mr. Posner, speaking at the evening of rededicating that sanctuary, spoke briefly, but to me, touchingly, in saying that he wanted to think of those who had been lost in the Holocaust, and he felt that this would be some sort of a memorial to those.
Mm-hmm. Very nice story. Did they change anything basically, something new?
Basically, no. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, maybe yes. If you recall the sanctuary as it was, mm-hmm. it tended to be dark. Mm-hmm. In the evening, it was almost gloomy. People thought that there were enormous building blocks on the upper walls. Those were not building blocks. A few years after the sanctuary was built, the acoustics were poor, and one of the engineers at Carnegie Tech devised an acoustical plan. There was horsehair up there, covered by perforated cloth, which was covered by a wood lattice work. Through the years, that cloth became discolored. We did clean it. In one of my early years here, I'd say about 30 to 35 years ago, that was cleaned. And I'm exaggerating slightly when I say that tons of grit and soot were sucked out, and yet the cloth was discolored. We were urged to just leave it alone. Most people fell for the optical illusion that the cloth were big stones, building blocks. In fact, a couple of people asked me what happened to those stones. All of that cloth, all of the horsehair, all of that was removed. And we went back to the original white plaster. Ehrenkranz and Eckstut, the name of the architectural firm, they went to the Columbia University archives and were able to find photographs of that sanctuary under construction, because Hornbostel used a very interesting architectural technique called a Giustovina arch. It was an interesting principle which fell into disuse almost immediately upon its use. But the company that installed those arches gave all of their papers, the Giustovina Company, to Columbia. So we have pictures which do indicate originally the walls of the sanctuary were white plaster. Well, we went back to that, which began to brighten the interior. The four chandeliers, I believe that each of them is taller than 10 feet, were lowered, were taken out of here, taken apart, restored beautifully. But for the moment, what's important to us is that we had new wiring. And with the new wiring, we could get juice to flow through without worrying about a fire. So we could put in larger bulbs. They have also enhanced the light quality in the sanctuary.
That's the most noticeable single thing.
Well, that's right. They shine. And it was funny, but we first used the sanctuary without the balcony, which was fire damaged and is still being repaired, on Erev Rosh Hashanah. The only complaint we heard was from some ladies who put on their sunglasses that it was too bright in the sanctuary. Of course, we have rheostats. We were afraid to touch any controls the first time, but for the next service, we were able to tone down the light. We had never had a complaint about too much light. There wasn't a sound system in the sanctuary in 1907. We didn't have the amplification. That was added subsequently, and sound systems are always a problem in big halls.
Yeah.
We have the latest technology. Instead of just a few speakers hanging on the walls, we have what is called a pewback system, a little speaker between every two and three seats. The pews are the original pews with the original seats or chairs. However, the seats have been upholstered with a blue velvet, and the backs have been upholstered with a blue velvet. We'd only had the wooden backs in the past. In the aisles, we have new carpeting with a pattern and a design, and we covered what were air returns in the aisles, which were usually risky for women when the fashion for women's shoes was spiked kinds of heels. Well, we were able to cover that because we have a totally different system of air returns. You'll be familiar if you look down in most big theaters, you will see something that looked like a turret out of the Maginot Line. Well, these are the air returns, and they're spaced throughout the sanctuary so that the former major air returns are no longer in use. I would say this is the basic outline, the brightness, everything in terms of the gold, wherever there was gold and gilding, have been renewed. To my taste, it's magnificent. There has been one addition to assist with the acoustics. A series of 10 plastic clouds have been installed. They are up high over the sanctuary, over the bima. Everybody notices them now. In time, we believe people will stop paying attention to them. In most of the big concert halls, when you look over the musicians,
there are enormous clouds.
The type will vary, but we've been assured that by installing these clouds, we will be improving the acoustical quality of the hall.
Mm-hmm. But they did add cushions on the seats.
Yes, that's correct. And on the back of the seats, we did add those cushions, yes. I don't know whether he did. Our associate rabbi, Rabbi Stateman, threatened that at his first service, as part of his sermon, he was going to tell the congregants that if the seats were now so comfortable that they were to fall asleep in front of him, he would have all of those comforts removed.
Yeah,
that's a good story. Are there any past events, I know none of this magnitude with respect to the property itself. I think the social hall may have been added during your tenure.
Yes,
is that true?
Yes.
Was there any point to recalling that?
Any point? Well, the building as it exists today is really in three parts. The original sanctuary from 1907, the school building with the Levy Hall, which faces Devonshire Street, in 1937-38, at the depths of our American Depression, we built that. And then the newest part of the building, which was completed in 1956. I was here in 1953, and one of my first tasks was to help Donald Steinfurst to organize a fundraising campaign. We raised approximately $1 million, which doesn't sound like much money today. However, in the dollars today, it would probably easily be $5 million.
Yes, more.
We demolished what was left of the original building because the wood was so dry it was like tinder and we were afraid. As part of that original building, there was an activities building which included a swimming pool, a basketball court. We abandoned using that when the YM and WHA moved down from the hill to Belfield Avenue so that our children would socialize with all the other Jewish children. That was demolished and we built the building which faces on Morwood Avenue. It's a totally different type of architecture. It's really what I call cheese box modern architecture, much lower ceilings. Alexander Shirov and Harry Lefkowitz were the architects for that particular building. An interesting story, a number of years later we added a sculpture. A sculpture was included at 5th and Morwood in the original plans. As an economy move, we abandoned that sculpture. But a number of years later, we had a competition. We invited about a dozen local sculptors to give us their idea as to what to do. Kent Bloomer, who was then on the faculty of CMU and is now on the faculty at Yale University, submitted the winning model. I knew it was a winner. There were other things I would have preferred: freestanding sculpture on that enormous lawn, a gorgeous glass wall of the burning bush. But as soon as Kent submitted that, I said to my secretary, "This is the winner." Mm-hmm. And she wanted to know how I knew. And I said it was an interesting architectural application of styrofoam reinforced with just bits of iron. It was very light, and he was hoping, that is, Kent Bloomer was hoping, that the building industry would adopt this for monumental sculptures on skyscrapers because of its lack of weight. It looks like a series of waves. I knew it would be a winner because when it was installed, most people would believe that nothing had happened. And those people who wanted sculpture would know that we had a monumental sculpture. So it was the most sensational compromise there could be. It is interesting. Architects and art students come by to look at it. They walk around the building because the shadows change the form depending upon where the sun is. What Bloomer's theory was, that he was marrying a 1907 sanctuary to a 1954 functional building. And he felt that this form, this sculpture, was a way of marrying two disparate architectural forms. And we believe it has worked.
I can't help seeing, calling it minimum art.
Well, I said it would be a winner. I knew it would be a winner. Well, I don't know. If you have never been in a committee which is discussing and debating art, it doesn't matter what aspect of art, you've missed one of the great thrills of life.
Yes, we've just been through that in Congress, didn't we?
Yes, we have.
That's right.
Do you have any idea of when the reconstruction will be finished?
Within a month or two.
And when did it start, just for the record?
Well, they were pretty much on schedule. The interior came last. They didn't work on that until January of this year, of 1990. All told, about 20, 21 months, beginning with the exterior, which was an enormous task. Not just the construction work, but getting the materials to get ceramics to match the 80-year-old, 85-year-old ceramics.
And the roof.
The dome must yes. Very complex. Difficult work, yeah. but they did it. I'm sure that the Gendico Construction Company and the Cost Company, which was the major subcontractor, brought in special kinds of artisans and craftsmen. And I'm also guessing that their construction workers had a special feeling. I believe I mentioned earlier that when we had that fire last summer, that the firefighters seemed to pay special attention, knowing that this was not an ordinary building that you chop apart and put back together again. I think that the workmen of those two companies had a special kind of feeling for restoring Rav Shalom Temple.
Yeah, that's a very good review of the building. It was an important point at such a major...
And yet, did I give you the anecdotal material when the building was on fire?
No,
I was
don't
too young.
That.
Well, it was terrible to behold. When I first saw the fire, actually so much smoke on Fifth Avenue, my heart sank. I thought,
when was the fire?
Oh, last, were we in July?
Summer.
But okay. When I came in the back of the building, I even came into my office and called my wife, who was in the hospital. She had already been watching it on TV. I said, "I'm calling from my office." "Are you crazy?" She said, "The building's on fire." I said, "I know, dear, but it's confined to a very small area on Fifth Avenue. It looks about 1,000 times as bad as it is." Well, there was nothing for me to do here, so I started to walk home. As I was crossing the street, I stood on the corner of 5th and Morwood Avenues, right at the corner of 5000 5th Avenue, and looked across diagonally. There was a small crowd there. The enormous crowd was directly across the temple on 5th Avenue. A youngish woman looked to me as though she was a graduate student at CMU in her mid-20s, looked up and asked, "Is that St. Paul's Cathedral on fire?" Another young woman said, "No, that's the Syria Mosque." So much for fame, historic buildings, and all the rest of it.
Wow, what a story.
Wow.
That should conclude it, right?
Yeah, that part,
and
yes.
And then you can think of your question.
Yeah. I'd like to go back to an earlier issue we had alluded to, the social change in Pittsburgh. When all of us arrived here, there was a totally different social atmosphere. I'm referring to the one of basic anti-Semitism in American society. I'd like to for you to remark on the evolutionary changes that, as you perceive them, it was national. But was there anything different about Pittsburgh? And particularly, I have your correspondence that you had with Roby and Kurtzman about the PAA, and I'd like that to go on the oral record.
I was chairman of the Jewish Community Relations Council for a few years. Lillian Friedberg, a wonderful woman and one of the true heroes of the Pittsburgh Jewish community. Ethics and prophetic message were uppermost in her work. We were a militant group, in terms of seeking the civil rights of all, with special emphasis on blacks. We'd be involved in going to Harrisburg to try to see the enactment of fair housing ordinances, fair accommodation ordinances. It's difficult for younger people today to believe that the hotels of Pittsburgh would not take then Negroes, now blacks, guests, that restaurants wouldn't accommodate them, that battles were fought to see that they would get their equal rights. And we were very militant with anything that we would believe smacked of anti-Semitism. We weren't looking for all kinds of newspaper headlines, but if there were anti-Semitic graffiti, we would go to the people who had the buildings or go to civic authorities to see that this sort of thing would not be repeated. We fought hard to see that schools would not schedule their final examinations on a Jewish holy day, or their initial examinations or registration on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which usually came in the fall. I don't want the JCRC to take all the credit or even too much credit, but we did make school administrators, they work closely with us, and our own Board of Education quite conscious of the problems we were bringing to their attention. It's almost ironic that as a result of the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers that Yom Kippur can now be a school holiday in Pittsburgh. In earlier years, we felt that there were some willful and negative and nasty people who would schedule things to the detriment of their Jewish students. We think there's relatively little of that to this particular date. Now, wait, the original, Howard, your specific question. Let me get back to the point.
The specific question was, I'd like to have the specifics of the...
At Pitt?
At Pitt, with Roby and Kurtzman and yourself. And,
all right. During,
and any other clubs that you may have had any contact with.
In Pittsburgh, for years, the Duquesne Club did not have a Jewish member. The University Club, which amazed visitors, academicians from other cities, the University Club did not have a Jewish member. The PAA had original members who were Jewish. Then they changed their bylaws so that those who were the founders and were Jews might still belong to the club, but they had no Jews after that. There was a struggle to get these clubs to open their membership to Jews. I was never a club member and never aspired to being a member of these clubs, but I, along with Lillian Friedberg, the American Jewish Committee Board, I was president of that agency at the time, realized that in terms of economic advancement, the Duquesne Club had to be open to Jews. So much of Pittsburgh's significant business was done over the lunch table in the Duquesne Club, and if Jews were excluded, they could only go so high in corporate life. To me, it was an economic issue. In fact, it's also ironic. There were some significant Jewish businesses. The owner or the chief of these businesses would not be admitted as a member of the Duquesne Club. So invariably, these corporations would have an important vice president who was not Jewish. He would become a member of the Duquesne Club and thus carry on the business as the other corporations would do. I know it was when I was president of the American Jewish Committee, I was also a member of the faculty at the University of Pittsburgh. When Litchfield was the chancellor at that time, there were lots of partying being done, and they were being done at all kinds of clubs, so that I might be invited to something at the PAA or the University Club under Pitt auspices. I just thought this was improper for a non-sectarian school like that. When David Kurtzman became the chancellor of the University of Pittsburgh, I wrote to one of his assistants when such meetings were being scheduled that I thought it was improper. I also thought it was unethical and immoral. I received a very nice letter in return. It was Fred Roby, who was one of Kurtzman's assistants, and Kurtzman did issue a directive that anything related to the University of Pittsburgh should be held in public places where all, regardless of race, religion, color, whatever it would be welcome. And I believe that that policy was instituted. I felt good as a human being, I felt good as a Jew, and I felt good as a faculty member. I might add parenthetically, I had been to other universities as an undergraduate, and one of the alumni clubs, I won't mention which, that doesn't matter, would invite me. They would have quarterly meetings, and they would usually be held in the PAA. I wrote to the president of the local group saying that this is a segregated club, and it's not proper to find a hotel. There were hotels where we could have luncheon meetings. I got back a lovely note saying he didn't understand why I was complaining, that the food was very good and the service was even better. So very often our adversaries don't even understand what our struggle is.
That's certainly true. You mentioned Litchfield, and I'm glad you did. Did you have any notion at all that Litchfield had any sensitivity to the issue at all, or was he like
no,
this?
My guess was not. If he had sensitivity, my guess is he would have eliminated what was, in my eyes, a problem. Mm-hmm. I know he was bringing in all kinds of faculty stars. Mm-hmm. Since I had been there long before that, mm-hmm. we didn't have many stars in the earlier years,
yes.
Many of whom were Jews.
Yeah.
I'm just guessing that he and his assistant and associate chancellors never gave it a thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recall that era, and probably what I would have thought, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to recapture the general atmosphere, that even the earlier one, which was much worse, you know,
yes.
the period of the 30s up through about 45, but at least the era you just covered was very good. I think I mentioned to you that I'd like to hear something about some of the more significant, I'm not sure that's the right term, congregants and presidents, as they might have influenced the atmosphere and the as they may have influenced the general ambiance here.
Well, I served with M.L. Aaron.
Yeah.
He was president for 19 years,
mm-hmm.
and he was elected president, and I was hired a few months later, so mm-hmm. I was with him all the 19 years. I knew S. Leo Russlander, who was an old man when I first knew him, and E.B. Strasburger.
Mm-hmm.
All three of these men were attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that they were conservative and that they believed in old line classical Reform Judaism mm-hmm. and tried to maintain Rode of Shalom pretty much in that mold. Mm-hmm. Changes always take place, but I would have to agree with people that change was imperceptible during a good bit of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Irving M. J. Kaplan followed M. L. Aaron in 1972. He was a younger man than the three. Irving M. J. Kaplan. He was one of the vice presidents of Copperweld, a very, very decent and ethical human being, very, very conservative. However, he overcame his conservatism and, along with the rabbis, or with Rabbi Jacob, introduced many different things. During his presidency, the custom of bar mitzvah was instituted. The congregation became deeply immersed in all sorts of social action projects. We even had a Head Start program here for a couple of summers. Behind the scenes, I was instrumental in seeing that we had it, because I'd read in our downtown papers that the Diocese of Pittsburgh had the whole Head Start program. It didn't seem right to me that one religion should have that whole program. So we instituted our own. It went very well. We had tutoring projects. We had link projects, things which have really fallen out of the vocabulary. But under Irving Kaplan, we became deeply involved. I say probably against his better class interest, but nonetheless he was a very, very good man. He was followed by Alan H. Berkman, who is still with us as a life trustee, and we engaged in another major building project. It's not as big or as glamorous, but...
What year was Berkman there?
76 mm-hmm. to 82. Mm-hmm. We had no parking. It's also interesting, when we were putting up our major addition, all we had was a driveway to the kitchen, period. We did not have one off-street parking space. Someone had bought a mansion on Moorwood next to us, demolished the mansion, and was going to subdivide and put up houses.